The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to this week's Tech Weekly, the podcast that educates, enlightens, and entertains so much it should be included under the BBC license fee. In fact, this week's episode is dedicated to the technologies that entertain, from the new virtual army of the next generation broadcasters to the future of drama. Joining me to chew over these subjects are Charles Arthur and Jemima Kish. Charles, welcome back. How was rehab? How was your week away?
My week away was exhausting because it was half term with all the kids. You heard some of that last week. I had a very productive week because I killed off about 150 feeds in my newsreader, which I never used to read.
That's
very still leaves
productive.
Me with 400, but oh. I'm working.
I've managed to come back with really pink cheeks today.
It's
I don't
radio.
Know why.
It's right. You don't have to tell people that you're menopausal.
Okay.
It's fine.
Yeah.
Anyway, on this week's episode, we're taking stock of the cult of the video blogger, a group of motivated young hipsters using the internet platform to get their voices heard and their faces seen. We'll be untangling the web of cross-media entertainment with the makers of Torchwood, the alternate reality game, and we'll be meeting business card and printmaking sensationalists Moo.com and The Lift for this week's elevator pitch. That, plus the news, your thoughts from the blogs, and all the scintillating conversation we can muster on Tech Weekly. Thank you very much for joining us. First up, Bobby's return from the beyond to bring us a sneak preview of his misadventures with the creme de la creme of video bloggers. Welcome back, Bobby. What put you on the trail of these new media broadcasters?
Well, it's really interesting, actually. Last year, I went to see a live recording of Dignation, which is one of the biggest online TV kind of web video shows out there, and that was held in London. And I really wasn't expecting much when I turned up. But suddenly, in this kind of hole in Docklands, suddenly like 1,000 kids turned up and they were all decked out in Dignation t-shirts and they were screaming. It was like they were at a rock concert. So I thought, you know, wow, this is very interesting. You don't normally get this kind of stuff on the technology beat. So in January, I met up with a bunch of the web video world's biggest names. And I took the chance while I was talking to them to delve a bit deeper into this kind of web video phenomenon. Is this just YouTube Plus or is this the future of telly? So first up, I grabbed Alex Albrecht from Dignation and I asked him whether he was just actually using this as a route into traditional TV.
I do 2 hours a week of talkie and that's enough for me. I mean, maybe we'll have those shows branch out to more, you know, some daily content. But, I mean, I've sort of hit that medium, as it were. And so for me, like, I have a production company here in L.A. With the Totally Retro guys, and we're working on an animated series for the web. We're working on a sitcom for the web. Like, that's the stuff. The scripted stuff is the stuff that gets me excited now because I feel like I've done that format of, you know, guys on a couch, guys in a garage, you know what I mean?
Like can you go from
where
there?
Can I go from there? Right, guys in the, I did the kitchen, you know what I mean? So it's like, I feel like...
Guys in the bathroom.
Yeah, bathroom, bedroom are the only two options left, and I don't think anybody wants to see any of that, so, yeah. You know. So we're going to go, I mean, we're leaning more towards scripted stuff, staying with the web, you know, I mean, to me, I kind of feel like it's the winning the lottery stuff. I mean, you know, any of the shows out there right now could have been Dignation. It's just we were at the right time. We had the right, you know, formula.
Dignation.com.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Dignation, episode number 137. I'm Kevin Rose.
And I'm Alex Albrecht. Dignation covers some of the hottest user-submitted stories on the social news website, dig.com. That's DIGG.com. We're here in San Francisco. Yes.
There are obviously a lot of people who think if they get big, yeah, online, then yeah, that's the one thing they're looking for, is a ticket to be on TV or,
right,
or whatever. Do you think that's an accurate representation? But also, do you think if people do think that, then they're missing a trick?
I don't think it's a one-to-one ratio of success online means you will be allowed to have an opportunity for success on television. That's not true. You have more avenues into that world than you would have if you were, you know, Joe Schmo off the street. That's definitely true. I'm happy that I get to do this as a profession. And whether it's on TV, whether it's on the web, that doesn't matter to me as long as I feel confident in the project and it's satisfying as a project. So, but I think a lot of people do feel that way where they're, you know, as I said, being somebody who lives in LA, you know, web series is the new independent film. I swear to God, every actor I meet in LA, they're like, oh yeah, I got this idea for a web series I'm going to do with my friends. And it's like, it's the new, you know, independent film. When digital video was available, like good quality digital video became available, every out-of-work actor shot a film. That's what they did. They were like, oh yeah, my buddy, we're doing an indie film. You know what I mean? And now, same thing. It's just, it's web series.
Alex Albrecht there from Dignation explaining exactly how people are now viewing web videos. Their viewing figures are around 400,000 a week, which puts them around the size of a digital station like BBC Four or Film Four. So, you know, it's pretty big. But not everyone's coming from the same position. I spoke to Zay Frank, who ran a really interesting video show for a year between 2006 and 2007 called The Show. And he explained exactly where he was coming from and what he thought people could get out of web video.
Good morning, sports racers. It's Tuesday, May 2nd since I've seen you last. I've slept for 220 minutes, taken one rumpled dump skin, and my average speed has been over 100 miles an hour. Join me as knowledge gets closer and closer to throwing up.
Today, I flew to France.
Air France gets a sports racer.
I had actually been doing some consulting work with television companies that were interested in thinking about online video, and specifically online video and its relationship to community. And I started sort of thinking about a format-less show and just really wanted to dive in. And it started with turning the camera on without any sort of explanation as to what was going on and, you know, just trying stuff out. I had decided not to write the shows in advance, so really trying to stay true to a real reactive kind of thing, you know, reacting to both the audience but also the kind of building context of the show. And very early, I think within the first month, I had announced that it was going to be a one-year show. And looking at the show as a conversation, the idea was, yeah, well, conversations end after a little while. And in fact, I have to, you know, I have to say that as the show became popular, there was a moment sort of midstream where, you know, I was playing with the idea of like, well, we could go dark and then just, you know, shoot up another show right afterwards or something like that. But in the show, some of the most interesting parts of the show that were happening were kind of the least sustainable. They required the most amount of work. They were these, you know, wonderfully rich contextual things where, you know, the audience was referring to things that happened a while back, and the show became harder and harder to come in to the outside from the outside and experience. You know, it became more and more confusing, and it became obvious that, you know, in order to make this thing sustainable, I would have to lose some of those cool conversational sort of dynamics and make it easier for people to understand and make less inside jokes and be a little less personal. And so, you know, I really felt at that time it was a better idea to pursue the non-sustainable things full force and just like close out the year, you know, paying respect to what had been created jointly between myself and the audience, rather than to try to slowly alter it into some sort of residual property. Now, I really feel, having been in stream for that year and then, you know, stepping back out of it, as, you know, direct-to-camera work becomes more and more commonplace, it loses some of the potential of having that kind of connectedness. And content isn't so much the issue. You know, there's a lot of great content out there. It's really about trying to find more, I guess, powerful stories.
Zay Frank from zayfrank.com there explaining how he learned a lot during his year of doing online video. Now, along with that, there are these new video studios setting themselves up. So Dignation is produced by a company called Revision 3. And another big online video podcast, Boing Boing TV, is run by Decca, which is a kind of rival production company. Now, I spoke to Jenny Jardin from Boing Boing and asked her, where do they think they're going? Where does it all go from here? How can they take it forward? And what does it mean for the future of TV?
We're not sure yet where this is going to go in terms of distribution, but we haven't ruled anything out, and we're talking to some different people. We don't want to just explode in too many different directions and have any of those decisions be unsustainable. The great thing about starting and incubating something like this online is that the web is a relatively forgiving medium. You have a sandbox to kind of experiment, try things, see what works, see what your audience really resonates with, and see what feels like the most fun. I think when we originally began talking about this, we were all thinking about this in terms of how to make content on Boing Boing, how to translate that into video. And months into it, we're not thinking that way anymore at all. This episode of Boing Boing TV is brought to you by Regional... express the same kind of curiosity in Boing Boing TV that we do on the blog, but they're different mediums.
What kind of effect, what way, you know, traditional TV guys and Hollywood guys, what do you think they're looking at and learning?
I've been gratefully surprised by the number of Hollywood guys and women who've come to us and said, like, this is the best thing I've ever seen on the internet, or I had no idea that this particular kind of thing was possible on the internet. It's amazing that you're able to do this with such modest production resources. I never would have thought of this, but it worked. We get feedback that makes me feel really happy that people like that who've been in the television, I'm thinking of one man in particular who's a very senior partner at one of the top three agencies. When I heard him say what he said about the show, I felt really happy. It's not television, and it's not a website, and it's maybe even just the idea of what YouTube is or the way that we access video now on the web. I think that will become dated pretty fast also. But I feel like we are in the beginning stages of something that will eventually become a common noun that we don't have yet.
Thanks to Bobby and the video blogger Jenny Jardin from Boing Boing TV, Alex Albrecht from Dig Nation, and Zay Frank from the show. So Bobby, how much of a threat do you think they are to traditional broadcasting?
Well, I think, you know, I don't want to make it sound like they're all going to storm the BBC or something and kick them all out on their behinds. But I thought when you take it back and you see what the physical, visceral reaction of a crowd is, some of these kids for Dig Nation were turning up from all over Europe just to see a live screening. Obviously, that's massively personality-led, but it also shows that you can kind of tap into the cultish aspect online in a way that kind of crosses the boundary between TV and the web. And that's something maybe that traditional TV companies have to look more closely at or try and work out how to use it. I mean, we're not talking about multi-million dollar studio productions either here. I mean, these things all have fairly low production values, but they're pulling in big audiences and people are lapping it up.
How do you think they'll change, though, if they are assumed into traditional broadcasting spaces?
I think the thing is that it won't necessarily feed into traditional, you know, I don't want to use kind of Chris Anderson's well-worn paradigm, but it is a kind of long tail of viewing that you can hit audiences anytime, anywhere, with a very specific niche topic of interest that they're into. And I think, you know, we might see the broadcasters, as they move forward with things like BBC iPlayer or Project Kangaroo or the other things that they're doing, we might see them start to realise that there's actually a really good value in these kind of small budget but big impact programmes.
Jemima, yeah.
Well, ownership is kind of an issue here. I think the people that listen to these feel that they have a bit more of an ownership over these people or that they're more accessible. And if you look at what happened to Amanda Congdon when she left Rocket Boom, very, very high profile, and she moved to, I think it was MSNBC, and now she kind of seems to have dropped off the radar a bit. And I just wonder if, you know, it was actually people endorsing Rocket Boom and that format rather than her, good as she is.
Well, it's sort of big fish, small pool, you know, and suddenly she's, a, you know, just a fish in a very big pool of MSNBC, which is, you know, that's the difference. The networks are vast and there's a lot of people. It's really hard to make your mark in them.
Well, thank you very much for that, Bobby, and of course Jemima and Charles and all the video bloggers. And readers can check that story out in full with extra colour in the weekend section with lots of glossy pictures or online at guardian.co.uk/technology from this Saturday. Now it's time for the news.
Blu-ray has won the battle of the high-definition DVD formats, with Toshiba admitting defeat and ditching HD DVD. Toshiba has been the main driver of the HD DVD format, but suffered a knockback last week when US retail giant Walmart announced it has opted for Blu-ray instead. The Yahoo-Microsoft battle rages on, with News Corp reviving talks to swap MySpace and a share in $7 billion of private equity for 20% of Yahoo. Microsoft will be deciding whether to up its offer or walk away and spend the cash on smaller web firms. Yahoo's shareholders, however, will be hoping the board opts for the financial orgasm of the Microsoft takeover. T-Mobile and Orange are partnering on a mobile TV project in West London, which will offer 100 channels in high quality during a trial this summer. The service will use the TD TV technology, which relies on a slice of 3G spectrum not yet exploited by the UK's five mobile operators. And Amazon Web Services went down on Friday morning, taking a number of Web 2 businesses with them. Amazon said it was proud of its service record and claimed 99% uptime, despite the two-hour downtime. But for companies reliant on the cloud computing service, that wasn't much consolation.
All right, Charles, this is the latest development in the HD DVD Blu-ray issue, the race. Has it been won by Sony?
Even if Toshiba decides to continue with HD DVD, that the decision by Walmart is really the final nail in the coffin. It's just not sustainable anymore because Blockbuster said it's only going to go with Blu-ray. Netflix has said it's only going to supply Blu-ray. Walmart has said it's only going to supply Blu-ray. Warner Brothers is moving to Blu-ray. I mean, you hear about no one who's going for HD DVD. The plus side, okay, for HD DVD owners out there, in about 20 years, you're going to have something you can sell on eBay for quite a lot of money. In the shorter term, for those of you who don't yet own an HD DVD player, wait about 7 months, you could probably go into any retail and you can name your price, because they'll be desperate to get rid of the buggers.
Is it like the kind of VHS versus Betamax situation where it was actually the porn industry that sort of determined which format would
actually no, it wasn't. No, the porn industry really hasn't got into it.
Is that just an urban myth?
It's not that we know about yet. We'll find this out quite
But that, is that true or not?
I've heard so many different versions of why it was that VHS won. I've heard that it was easier to service. Clive James told me that. Some people say it was because the VHS players could go back and forth better. No one quite knows why it is that VHS won. The fact is it did, and Sony lost in that time. This time around, it's not the porn industry that's won it this time. It's definitely the film studios that have done it, and all the others have just joined in and stamped on HD DVD's head.
It's got a better name, though. Kind of
Blu-ray.
I
mean HD DVD. It just does what it says on the tin, doesn't it?
No, I mean, Nick Carr did a blog about this over the weekend, and he said, you know, if the Jetsons were going to buy a dog, it'd be called Blu-ray.
And also the Amazon story was quite interesting. Charles, we were talking about this before in terms of the fact that we talk about distributed computing being a great thing, but it seems that this suggests that everybody's sort of localized in one place anyway.
The Amazon Web Services is all lots of distributed computing. You know, you never know quite where the data lives, but there is a single point of failure. There is always one place where things can go wrong, which in this case was the authentication server, which was looking at if you were trying to reach an Amazon Web Services supply, it would say, well, who are you trying to get at this web services supply? The server, for some reason, overloaded and basically denied loads of people. It's interesting because this is the same sort of problem that Skype faced. It did an update to its software. This was a few months ago, and everyone found that Skype vanished off the network because they were all trying to log into the authentication server at the same time. So it's intriguing because we think of cloud computing as being, you know, it doesn't matter where it is, it's replicated, it's always safe. But when you have a single point of failure like the authentication system, then it's actually just as unrobust as all the old stuff.
Well, there's this scintillating discussion and more tech news all week at guardian.co.uk/technology.
Torchwood, outside the government, beyond the police, fighting for the future on behalf of the human race. The 21st century is when everything changes, and Torchwood is ready.
People who watch the BBC's Doctor Who spin-off Torchwood on TV are only getting half the story. On the internet, the characters live on between episodes, tripping through space-time, battling aliens, and getting to grips with one another. But far from the realm of fan fiction, this is an alternative reality wholly created by the BBC itself, part of an alternate reality game which producer Matt Fidel and Torchwood writer Phil Ford have developed to flesh out the story experience. The game uses properties from the televised show, but expands on them with specially recorded video footage and mysteries for players to solve. Part brand extension and part user-generated content, the alternate reality game represents a new cross-media direction for the future of entertainment. I met with Matt and Phil to discuss what the BBC hopes to do in this space and began by asking them how the Torchwood mission fits into the Torchwood universe.
To me, the idea was that it was something where you could watch the TV show and then you would go and play online, and actually that would be pretty seamless, which has caused quite a few issues, I guess, in terms of having to know what happens in each episode and working out whether we can actually have certain characters do certain things simply because of what's happened to them in that episode. Obviously, I can't say certain things because of the spoilers for episodes come up.
And how the Torchwood alternate reality game, how the ARG sort of plays out, what types of things do people do? What do they see when they go into the website?
We've kind of used a mix of media, but what we've tried to do is we know the characters are the big pull for the audience. So anything that you get from Yanto or Tosh or other people who've yet to crop up, they're always video because, you know, we know that's what people want to see.
And Phil, that's quite exciting to know that the character is the most important bit for the viewers and for the people who are taking part in the alternate reality game. What kinds of things do you have to think about when you're writing for interactivity as opposed to writing for television?
Well, the character is always the most important part of any story. Actually, it's quite interesting. When I came on board to do this, it was like a huge challenge because this kind of game in this way has never been done in this country before alongside a show like Torchwood. And when you're writing a screenplay for an episode of Torchwood, you are in control. The writer is in control. With the ARG, there's much more actually on whoever is playing because it's obviously interactive. So that seemed like a huge challenge in terms of you have to get the player to move things along. But the interesting thing is that when you're writing a show, an episode, a story breaks down into a series of beats, if you like. One beat leads on to the next event, and those events build up the story. Actually, this game operates in the same way because the player has to solve clues, has to move the game along. So those beats were actually there.
Our focus was very much on the narrative, on the characters. You know, are you going to really want to solve some complex algorithm? How Torchwood is that? It's not something you see done in an episode.
One thing that I'm hearing is that while the players are engaged with it at one level, there's not a lot of feedback to the ARG or to the show itself. And I'm wondering if there's any possibility in future for that kind of interactivity to happen.
Because we were so late on in the process when somebody came up with the bright idea of doing this, that actually, you know, the show was already written, filmed, etc. I mean, we've done this in an incredibly short amount of time, but we didn't have that option. It's been interesting, actually, how many options we've had, how many decisions we've been able to make, which make it seem more integrated with the show. And I think the Dark Talk radio show, which Phil created, has enabled us to give that impression. Obviously, when you integrate completely with the show, is that gives you a whole bunch of new headaches for simply the show's scheduling. You know, we don't actually know what the show's schedule is going to be until 2 weeks before that episode goes out. It just gives you so many headaches. How is this going to work if suddenly they're going to show episode 6 straight after episode 5 on BBC Three? How, you know, that those sort of problems, you know, you can't plan ahead for those 9 months in advance. What you can do is just kind of leave bubbles within the TV broadcast and actually within the game itself, which are bubbles of space which you can fill at the last minute.
What are the best technologies that you guys have used?
Well, for me, the most enjoyable bit has been Dark Talk, which when Phil and I first started talking about the ARG, Phil came back to me with this idea and said, I think we should do a radio show. And I thought, hey, that's great. I haven't got any budget to do it, but let's do it anyway. And then we decided that we'd film the radio show, at which point I think the budget just went out the window. But it's the simplest piece of technology you can ever imagine, which is not even the radio show. It's simply allowing people to ring in, which we then just edit up and put back into next week's show. Some people are just incredibly inventive and really creative, and those are inevitably the ones we end up using.
Taking one final question, one step back and looking at the big picture, when you guys were researching alternate reality games for this, I'm wondering what you saw that you wish you'd been able to bring in. You said that you're sort of time stretched. Some other cross-media implementations that you saw and went, wow, that is so cool. If we had 9 months, we would bring this in.
I think the one thing that caught my eye when I was doing research was, and I can't even remember which game this is, but they'd set up that guys had to steal a car from some motor show, and the guy who was actually delivering the car to the motor show, one of the puppet masters, as we call them, had forgotten to leave the keys in the car. And so these guys turned up to actually nick it, discovered that it couldn't, so just took pictures of themselves with it and put them up on Flickr. And I just loved that. A, the idea that there was a real physical element to it, but actually when things didn't come off, people actually moved it on themselves anyway. They were so bought into the concept. So I think I would love to do something that was more physical, especially seeing as how in Torchwood we have a real location. We have Cardiff.
I can see the headline, BBC condones car theft.
Yeah, well, that was funny enough, one of the reasons why we didn't use that. But next time, you know, we always like to push the boundaries.
That's it. Excellent. So can you tell me if anything that you've said thus far has been a clue?
I mean, I think a lot of what we talked about so far has just been blue sky. Wouldn't you say that, Phil?
Yes, yes.
Ooh, I think there's a clue there. So, Jemima, there's no feedback loop, and Matt readily admits that. Isn't this just a marketing ploy?
Well, it's hard to see how it isn't, really. I mean, I'm sure their hearts are in the right place, and it's good that they even thought about, I don't know if they even call it 360-degree commissioning anymore. But if you look at projects like Channel 4's Big Art Mob, it's a kind of mobile blogging tool, and their project is to map the UK's public art. And that's out for a year before the programme is broadcast, and it's taken on a life of its own. You really need that kind of imagination and that kind of agency given to the people that are working on these projects for them to get anywhere. The more you put in, the more you're going to get out of it.
You know, if you had a bit of blue sky going out there, what kinds of cross-media technologies do you think would really push an ARG into something that's quite revolutionary?
I think GPS and treasure hunts is really the sort of way to go, because more and more phones, more and more mobile phones are getting GPS now. Treasure hunts has been a real favourite of people who've owned, you know, the handheld GPS systems for ages. You know, remember how in the days before we had computers, Kit Williams buried this rabbit made of gold somewhere on the side of a hill.
Well, thank you very much to Matt and Phil from the BBC, and you can find out more from bbc.co.uk/Torchwood. It's time for Elevator Pitch, when our startup pitbull Jemima demands the dirty from new web entrepreneurs. Let's see who's in the cage this week.
Welcome to Elevator Pitch.
Ground floor. Please mind the doors.
Which floor would you like?
Stationary, please.
Going up.
So, who are you and what's your company?
My name's Richard Moross. I'm the founder and chief executive of Moo.com.
Okay, then. Explain your business to my mum in 2 sentences.
Hello, Jemima's mum. We're basically an online stationer. We sell all sorts of things, from greeting cards, postcards, stickers and business cards. You, as the consumer, have a huge say in what the product actually looks like. So you can use your own images, or you can choose from hundreds of thousands of designs that were created by other members of the public. So it's a sort of people-powered stationer, if you like.
First floor.
So how are you funded, then?
We took an angel round of investment in 2004, some seed money, and then in 2006 we did a venture round with some larger investors.
So how do you make money?
We buy print at X and we sell print at Y, except we actually sell print at Y and then buy print at X. So it's sort of twist on a very old business model.
Second floor.
Okay, so who are you competing with?
The business is most alike us in terms of product offering, I'd say. Probably this is like American Greetings and Hallmark. They've been pretty much doing the same thing for 100 years. in excellent fashion. But I think there's exciting new technology coming out. There's exciting new visions of what a greeting card or a business card can be. But those are the types of businesses that we aspire to be like, or to create a future where we are the American greetings of 100 years from now.
So what's your biggest challenge?
Trying to be the American greetings of the future. Ours is just getting in front of enough people, because it's very offline, so it's not like you can just send an email. Our product literally moves from hand to hand, from party to party, or from playground to playground. And that's sort of a slow process, really.
Third floor.
And if you had £10 million to invest in any company other than your own, what would you invest in?
I wouldn't mind owning shares in Facebook, but probably not at the current valuation. I think the most excitement investment I've seen recently is probably Etsy. They took about $27, $28 million in the last 3 weeks or so. I think that was a really exciting investment, and it's an exciting business.
Do you think there's a new Web2 bubble?
In Thailand, same but different. But it's very, very different to the last time. You know, all of the people that were involved then have grown up, and they've built business plans and business models into their, and revenue streams into their businesses. So it's certainly a much more mature and interesting time, but it does bear some of the hallmarks, certainly with regards to investment. But that's the business of venture capital, is placing some bets, and 1 in 10 comes off.
Fourth floor, doors open.
Hold on, this isn't my floor.
Thanks to Richard Maras from Moo. And now, I love Moo cards. They're small, they're cute, they're interesting.
They're losable.
They're very losable, that's true. But they're in full glossy colour. But what do you think that they need to ensure that their fashionable property isn't just a gimmick?
They have achieved that level of gimmickry, I suppose, in a positive way that's got them kind of known. As soon as you see someone with a Moo card, because it's such a distinctive size, you know that's a Moo card.
That's what we want, as
but
essential gimmicks.
They're kind of a bit of a status symbol now as well among that kind of community. Mm. So I suppose their challenge is going a bit more mainstream than that, really.
Do you think that their business model is going to be quite severely affected as good printing technologies come into the home?
No, because they're professionally printed. It's like a kind of validation of your own work in a way. And so seeing your stuff printed on postcards or stickers, it's quite a buzz.
They've already done a really good job demonstrating, you know, their business nous by getting high-profile partnerships with people like Flickr, whom they mentioned, and also Virtual World Second Life. You can also buy Moo cards for your Second Life avatars and whatever else you build inside there. If you guys were in their shoes, who would you target next? Who would you then try and get cozy with next?
Well, I don't think they need one or two big partners. I think their trick would be just a little bit everywhere.
Oh, well, big warm fuzzy hugs for Moo, isn't it? And if you'd like to get such treatment, then you can send your pitches to jemima@guardian.co.uk. Actually, it's jemima.kish@guardian.co.uk.
It is, actually,
it?
Yes. And that's Kish, K-I-S-S for sugar.
It's time for us to stop talking and to listen to what you have to say. Unfortunately, we have to read your comments out, so we'll just have to keep talking. But the words are yours. First up, let's hear from the Games blog. Last week, Keith asked one of his very clever questions again. Has gaming had its punk moment? Overwhelmingly, everybody on the Games blog has said, no, there's been no punk moment.
It's not the prog rock of whatever games are now. It's the Sex Pistols and Sham 69.
Exactly. Some people thought perhaps Grand Theft Auto was a punk moment. Some people thought Manhunt. Other people thought things like Metal Gear Solid was a punk moment. Well, Parker Digital and Beethoven, which I really like that name, Beethoven, they both had very similar thoughts about this. Parker Digital said that one of the defining factors in punk was that you didn't have to be a particularly competent musician to make great punk music. Developing video games is bloody difficult, though, and just having an idea for a great game isn't going to get you far. You'll either need very good first-hand knowledge of programming or know someone who does. But a lot of people were also talking about this hope for the indies, thinking that perhaps new distribution platforms would be a place where punk rock anarchy developers would come along and produce some stuff. So Beethoven says, I'd say gaming is still waiting for its version of punk to happen. The high cost of developing video games, again, kind of prevents that lo-fi ethic that punk embodied. Hopefully things like Microsoft's XNA program will encourage developers to mess with gaming conventions a little bit more. That's what's been going on in the Games blog. Jemima, what do you have to tell us from
digital content?
Well, I've been told off for talking about Facebook too much. And I do talk about Facebook a lot, but it's a very influential website anyway. Onion Gravy, who's a bit of a regular over on Media Guardian, has chipped in on an elevator pitch, actually, which was a guy called Lee Washington, who's a student at the Central School of Art and Design, and he sells kind of Facebook-inspired T-shirts and kind of quite cool, quirky handwriting and stuff. And you always think of applications being the kind of spin-off companies, but, you know, this guy sold a few hundred T-shirts and good on him. And Onion Gravy wrote, "Jemima, we love you dearly, but are you seriously on Facebook's payroll? Or do you have a bet with a friend that as to how low you can set the bar on Facebook articles? By the way, my friend's daughter, 16 brackets, told me last week that everyone is so over Facebook."
You've been told, haven't you?
I have been told.
I'm quite over Facebook as well.
Well, so am I. But they're doing the R&D for the industry and a lot of the kind of targeted advertising they're doing. And also their application developer platform, obviously, is having a knock-on effect and everyone's taking notice. So I stand by my coverage of Facebook.
You stand beside it and people throw rotten fruit at you, mostly.
Charles, what do you stand beside this week?
The announcement by Play.com that it was going to be selling DRM-free MP3 music files from 65 pence came out last Wednesday and attracted a lot of discussion about the benefits of subscription-based services, of pay-per-track services. And I was rather taken with the comment by Toots66, the discussion moved on to emusic.co.uk, where you pay a monthly subscription and you can download up to 30 tracks. Toots66 pointed out when someone had said, well, that works out only 30 pence a track. That's 30p a track only if you can find 30 tracks to buy in a month. If you can only find one that you want, then it's £8.99 per track. I tried eMusic 25 tracks free trial once and managed only 21.
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually. It's horses for courses, I suppose, but I just would not want to commit to paying a huge chunk each month. I'm very sort of sporadic with my music buying. I think I've bought 5 albums online in the last month, but I don't know if I'm going to do that next month.
Well, thank you very much to everyone. And please do feel free to comment on these issues and more at blogs.guardian.co.uk/games/technology/digital-content. We'll pick out the best for next week's show.
I'm Alok Jha, and on the latest Science Weekly podcast, we're here in Boston for the AAAS Science Conference discussing the future and safety of our food. Are you ready to start eating cloned meat and GM cornflakes? Also in the show, how close are we to discovering life on Mars? NASA's Stephen Squires from the Mars Rover missions details the next stage of exploring the red planet. Plus, inventor and futurist Raymond Kurzweil tells us why technology is going to save the world. It's all on the New Science Weekly at guardian.co.uk/audio.
Well, we're almost done for this week, but before we go, we couldn't possibly leave without having a blatant plug for the technology section. Charles, what can we expect in the newsstands on Thursday?
I'm going to be looking at the new strategy document that's coming out from the government on Friday, which threatens ISPs with legislation over file sharing and trying to get to the bottom of exactly who's threatening whom with what. We'll be looking at eBay's big row that it's having with its sellers over whether they can put feedback about their buyers. In Free Our Data, we're going to be looking at the price of death and specifically the price of getting a list of who's died in the past year. We've got an exclusive interview with Jonathan Schwartz, who's the chief executive of Sun. We look at games that read your mind. That's literally read your mind. Nick Carr is going to be looking at how many computers there are in the world, and it's rather smaller than you think. Vic Keegan on what Yahoo really offers. And I'm going to be looking at some research which shows, incidentally, why Apple's secrecy strategy over its product announcement really works.
Well, thank you very much for that. And now, is Charles being open and honest with us? Let's find out. Grab a copy of the paper for yourself on Thursday to see. In the meantime, back to more pressing matters, next week's podcast and closing out this week's show. If you've got something to say to us, you can do. Please, via the regular channels and also at tech@guardian.co.uk. In fact, Jemima, you wanted some feedback.
I'm hatching a plan. For some unknown reason, I've been invited to the Brit Awards, which is slightly scary. On Wednesday, not perform, actually. I was just thinking of making a point, really, and wearing a kind of T-shirt dress or something that says file sharer on the front, Catherine Hamlet style.
I think that's an awesome
idea. Or a dirty great LimeWire logo. Not because I endorse nicking music or not paying for it, but just to make a bloody point that the music industry is so backward in addressing all of these issues and facing up to the opportunity, actually, because I do think it's a, you know, there's so many positive kind of opportunities. I might get lynched.
If you think that Jemima should or should not wear a file sharing or LimeWire t-shirt to the Brits, then please do get in touch. It's happening on Wednesday, isn't it?
Yeah, so. I'll be down at American Apparels in Portobello Road.
Anyway, thank you very much to
for
everyone, including Matt and Phil from the BBC, Richard from Moo, the video bloggers,
audio.
Jemima, Charles, the absent Bobby, and Scott, our producer. I'm Alex Krotowski, and you've been listening to Tech Weekly from The Guardian.